All right. Okay, so I really didn't know how to introduce the speaker tonight, but on the way here, he kind of gave me an idea. So this is my sponsor, and he rarely answers the phone. Like, I don't really know anybody that doesn't have a smartphone. This man insists on not having a smartphone. Never answers the phone. Well, I won't say never. Very rarely answers the phone. So I'm calling. I'm supposed to pick him up. I'm like, you know, so there goes Friday night speaker meeting. We don't have a speaker. And lo and behold, I get a call back. But that, a lot of the things about my sponsor just remind me of really the 12th step to just practice these principles in all our affairs, that I need to do that. And that just comes about because, like, I hear a lot of rules in AA, a lot of people that are fixated on the big book, and, like, that's fine. But what worked for me was this man's ability to help me focus on spirituality, help me understand the program in a way that I'm able to work it. Because it was very easy for me to get lost in, like, in the program, and everybody has a different way of doing it, and I was just fortunate enough to find somebody that's helped me do it in a way in which I'm successful, and I'm very grateful for that. Some people might know him as the guy that never wears shoes. Some people might know him as summer attire Santa, but now I know him as my sponsor, and I'm very happy to introduce your speaker for tonight, John W.
Good evening, folks. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date, October 15th, 2011. And I share that with you because, you know, you get started in this thing, and the only time I really remember my sobriety date is when I check in at the Saturday Morning Professionals Group, because you got to remember it. I share it with you I think if I can do it, anybody can do it. As I was leaving the office this afternoon and trying to remember where I parked my car, I said, I've got to tell my story tonight. I'm a smidge on the old side. How can I remember my whole life? So I thought I would recommend a book for you that I read a couple of years into sobriety by David Carr, called The Night of the Gun. David was a cocaine addict and an alcoholic and an amazing reporter for the New York Times. And after he got sober, I think it was at least 10 years after he got sober, he went back to talk to his friends from his drinking and drugging days to ask them what they remembered about their stories, about the stories that he remembered. And the title of the book is related to the fact that he said he went to somebody's house when he was high, and when the guy answered the door, the guy at the door had a gun. And then when he went back 10 years later to talk to this same guy, the guy said, no, David, you're the one that had the gun. So, you know, our memories, particularly in addiction, can be a little bit fuzzy. Because when I drank to oblivion. I drank to blackout. I didn't want to experience life. So remembering that time of my addiction is a little bit of a challenge. So I think really what I'm gonna do is spend a little bit more on what's happened since I came to Ridgeview, tell you a little bit about myself. I don't want to share my age, but I'll tell you that when I was born, there were only 2.5 billion people on the Earth's surface. There's now 7.6. You can try and figure out how long ago that was. I was born in northern Indiana in a very conservative farming town. And by the time I made it to the first grade, I knew I didn't fit in. I had arguments with my first grade teacher. I told her that blue jays eat birds' eggs and baby birds and stuff, and she said, "Oh no, John, they don't." So John went home and got his bird book, took the bird book in, showed his teacher. He was right, she was wrong. And that was the beginning of my academic career. And so the first thing is I'm willing to argue. And the other thing is that I'm a contrarian. So that's an important tradition in some Native American communities where you say hello, I say goodbye. You say good day, I say good night. And I tend to disagree with everybody. I do it more facetiously now than I used to, but I still haven't gotten rid of that trait. So school was not all that much fun because I always wanted to argue with the teachers. And I never felt like I belonged in that place. I can remember so I'm just going to skip ahead to high school. Well, first of all, I can remember my first drink. It was out of a gallon of Gallo wine behind the bleachers on a Friday night during a high school football game. And when I did that, I said, wow, now I feel right in my skin. Being in this condition makes me feel right and good, and I'm not worried. So that was the beginning of my drinking career, 15, 16 years old. But in Indiana, getting alcohol was a bit of a problem. Oddly enough, it was easier to find cannabis and other drugs, and so I did those in high school too. And it was really to try and make myself feel comfortable in my skin. The story that I'll share with you from high school is I was in high school English class, and the teacher asked us to interpret a poem, give us our interpretation of a poem. And so I did that, and the teacher told me I was wrong. And I said to her, wait a minute, you asked for my interpretation of this poem. How can I be wrong because it's my interpretation? And we had a bit of a tussle over that. And then a few days later, she came into the classroom and she said, John, you've been recommended to become a member of the Honor Council, or the Honor Society. You know, big deal back then in high school. And she said, I just want to tell you, you're never going to be in there because I'm always going to make sure you don't make it. So by the time I graduated from high school, I started to become really rebellious. I graduated from high school in 1968. As many of you know, there was a war going on then. And you don't have to agree with my politics, but I was opposed to the war in Vietnam. And that was not a good thing in Indiana. And I would go to demonstrations. I did most of my university work at I started at Purdue University. Bad move. We the first spring we were protesting because the university increased the tuition by 75%. Some of us didn't think that was right. I lived in the student center for a month. And I've had a really lucky life, because the night I went home to take a shower, the police busted everybody that was in there, kicked them out of university. They could never go there again. So I did a lot of that activism when I was a university student, and it was partly a reaction to. I'm not a big fan of solving problems with wars. And I made the determination and I was raised in a very fundamentalist church, and I cannot repeat what was in the church bulletin about what I should do. But it was basically kill somebody from Vietnam for God. And if you protest the war in Vietnam, you're going to go to hell. And I threw the baby out with the bathwater. So any religion that I had stopped about the time I went to university, because if the God of my church was telling me that I was going to go to hell for being against a war, maybe that wasn't mine. And that's an important part in the story, because I lost, not only did I lose religion when I was 20 years old, but I lost any spirituality that I had. And it turns out that in the journey that I've taken, that spirituality is what saved my butt. So university was a pretty raucous time. My undergraduate grades weren't all that hot because I was in Washington, D.C. too much doing other things. I worked for political candidates, and again, I'm going to mention the political candidate from 1972. Can remember who that was? George McGovern. I worked my butt off for George. And went home that night. What did he do? He carried one state in the District of Columbia. And so I left this country for 25 years. I went to Canada to graduate school. I stayed for 25 years and then came back. But along that road of moving to Canada, I married my high school sweetheart. And 1978, we bought a 100-acre farm. I'm working full-time at the university. I'm trying to look after a sheep farm with 125 breeding ewes. So when they have lambs, there's like 350, 400 of them. And then in the mid-80s, I decided I should go back and get my PhD. Farming, full-time job, PhD. There's another one of my character defects that I didn't recognize until I came into recovery. I'm not only an alcoholic, but I'm a workaholic. And that workaholism eventually is what led me to Ridgeview, because I was working someplace between 80 and 100 hours a week, which I would give you advice on this. And it's just a suggestion, don't. Just don't do that. So I moved to Canada. I thought I had a really good life. My plan was to die on the farm as a farmer. And then in the early 90s, my first wife decided the romance was gone from our relationship. And she went looking for somebody else. And I will share with you tonight the person that she found in 1992 was older than I am today. That was a bit of an issue for me. And I still really loved her, and we went through this, and you know, it was back and forth and back and forth, and it was a tumultuous 2 years. And in retrospect, I'm really impressed I didn't become an alcoholic in the early 90s, because I was having panic attacks every day. I couldn't sleep. There were nights she wouldn't come home, and I'd just get in the truck and drive wherever I could because I couldn't stand being at home. But, I mean, I drank. I had a couple of beers every night, but I didn't drink to excess. And again, in recovery, I learned why that was, that I didn't turn to alcohol at that time, because I had a circle of friends that cared for me and looked after me, a lot like AA does. And so they helped me get through that. And I wish I had learned the lesson back then. So in the mid-90s, I met the person who would become my second wife, who in retrospect, I think probably would have been a great patient at Ridgeview Institute. We married, and she was a Canadian. 80 degrees Fahrenheit is cold for her. So she said, okay, here's the line on the map. You'll apply to jobs south of that. So I did. And she promised me that all the weird behaviors would disappear if we moved, because then she'd be happy in the United States, right? Geographic solutions, I don't think work. They sure the heck didn't work for her. So we moved here with two of her children. I started working at Emory University. And I didn't have any friends. I didn't have anybody to talk to. And the marriage very quickly started to go south. And some of you have probably experienced this. If you got a spare bedroom in the house, there's the husband in one and the wife in the other. And that's what it was like. And in fact, we would both try and figure out what our the other person's schedule was, so that we didn't have to even see each other in the house. Well, I didn't have any friends. I was really depressed. I was getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning with panic attacks and going to work. Another suggestion, don't do that unless you're working the night shift. And so I started drinking and isolating myself in the bedroom. And I drank a little bit more, and I drank a little bit more. Oh yeah, and I drank a little bit more. And we finally got divorced, but the drinking didn't go away because now I was hooked. And besides, I was suffering from anxiety, and I went to my family doctor, and he says, do I have the answer for you? There's this little pill called Xanax. And if you start taking Xanax, you'll become much less anxious. Now, I don't know if you've ever taken Xanax, but what it said on my pill bottle, well, I'll tell you what it said on my pill bottle, and then I'll tell you what I learned it really said to me. It says, alcohol may accentuate the effect. So I took my Xanax with some scotch, right? Makes perfect sense. Other advice, don't do that. And the combination of the alcohol and the Xanax didn't really work. So then I got my physician to give me Klonopin at night. So I'm taking Xanax in the morning, Klonopin at night, and I'm drinking a fifth of whiskey a night, a day. Not very good. So, you know, can I tell you what I did? And it was, this was in a fairly short time period. It was from about 2004 to the time I came into Ridgeview, 2011. I had one weird psychiatrist that said, you're actually only supposed to be on those benzos for a short period of time. I'm going to take you off them. And the panic attacks came back, and I became almost dysfunctional. There were days I just didn't want to get out of bed. And my life was miserable. It was truly miserable. And I didn't know what to do. I knew I should stop drinking, and I can't count the number of times I stopped drinking. The stopping was for me pretty easy. The staying stopped, didn't work very well. So I could go a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, maybe 5 weeks without a drink, and then I would go, I'm angry, I'm happy, I'm sad, I deserve a drink. Also, I got into the habit of thinking that I could drink on any day that ended with a Y. So I quit several times. I talked to my psychologist who was in Al-Anon. He said, maybe you should try that AA stuff. I said, no. I'm a loner. I'm an introvert by nature. I don't like being around people. There's no way I'm going to go and spill my guts out in a room of other human beings. I went to see an addictionologist. The addictionologist said, you know, you probably need to go to a treatment center and maybe you need AA. And of course, I knew better. There was no way that I should go into a treatment center. I was too important. They couldn't fill my job. You know, my job wouldn't be done without me. It would just be terrible. The whole world would fall apart. Oh, yes, I forgot. I'm going to go back to 2005. So when you drink a fifth of whiskey a day, it turns out that it can do damage to your body. And so about 2005, I had my first attack of pancreatitis, which is a very unpleasant thing to have. But it was because I was dehydrated, or it was just because I had come back from visiting my father in Indiana, and that's all it was. It had nothing to do with the alcohol. And then I was visiting my father in Indiana, and I had my second attack of pancreatitis. He was suffering from dementia at that point, and I had to leave a note where he was going to eat breakfast the next morning to say, Dad, I've driven myself to the hospital. Don't expect to see me for a while. And that really messed up that old man, and I really regret it. And it was that second attack of pancreatitis that made me an insulin-dependent diabetic. So did I stop drinking at that point? The day I came into Ridgeview to do the evaluation, they did the evaluation and they said, you're gonna fit in here really well. And I said I wasn't feeling well. And I said, is there a hospital nearby? And it was actually a hospital next door at the time, and they took me over, and that was attack number 7 of pancreatitis. You want to talk about insanity? Right here. And I just would never accept that it was the alcohol. It was something else that was giving me that pancreatitis. And I fit, you know, you, as an alcoholic and a diabetic, you mess with your insulin so that you can balance all those carbs in what you're drinking, and it's a really interesting adventure. And I think what finally happened, and this has to do with my being a contrarian, and this worked in my favor. So I went to see the people at the faculty staff assistance program at the university to talk to somebody. There's got to be something he can do. He said, you need to go to Ridgeview. He didn't say go to a treatment center. He said, you need to go to Ridgeview. And I said, no, I don't need that. And he said, no, I assure you, you need to go to Ridgeview. And I said, no, that's just bull hockeys. And then he said it one more time. No, you really need to go into treatment. And I said, you bastard, I'll show you. I'm going to go to this place and it's not going to work. Insanity. So I came to Ridgeview in the fall of 2011, right after I finished my seventh attack of pancreatitis. My nerves were so fried, I could not walk a straight line. Actually, I think I was probably 3 or 4 months sober before I could pass a field sobriety test. That's how messed up I had done to my nervous system. The good news is I think I can now pass a field sobriety test, which is pretty cool. So I did the time at Ridgeview. I learned a whole bunch about alcoholism, and that in fact, once I became a pickle, I couldn't go back to being a cucumber. That was a bit of a drag. And, oh, by the way, I couldn't do the benzos anymore either. That wasn't good news either. And they weaned me off the benzos. I made it through treatment. John the contrarian, I'm not saying you should do this. So my psychiatrist, my manager, the head of the professionals program, and my sponsor at the time said I needed to go to a halfway house for 3 months. You can guess what I did. I went home. The good news is I didn't drink, and in fact, that wasn't that much of a problem. Okay, I minimized it. It was a problem, but it was easier to not drink than it was to try not to have a panic attack without medication. I continued to have panic attacks for another 9 months. And in retrospect, I think, although I like living by myself, I think if I had gone to the halfway house, it would have eased me back and I wouldn't have just gone back to having panic attacks like that. So when they tell you go, please go. Don't do what John did, because it was a mistake. Just because I didn't pick up alcohol or drugs doesn't mean that that was the right thing to do. I really should have gone. And then I started working a program. And I switched sponsors sometime in the middle because my first sponsor, you think I don't answer the phone. This guy would get up at 4:30 to go to work in the morning and get home at 8:30 at night. And you had to call him between 8:30 and 9 if you had any hope of getting him on the phone. Best sponsor in the world, he never answers the phone, and you can say you phoned your sponsor last night. Don't do that. And I didn't know what I was doing when I chose that first sponsor, although, you know, he picked up a one-year chip or something, and I asked him, and he said, sure. And he was a really great guy, but he just wasn't available. And then I spent a lot of time at Ridgeview, and I talked with this fellow over here, and he was willing to take me on, and I'm not a good sponsee. But he's sort of, right, see, he's laughing. Anyway, but he was my rock early on. And then I started to sort of get it. That I wasn't God. And I didn't have one, so I needed to find one. And I'd had a little bit, but where I found my God or my direction was people in these rooms. And there's three or four of them in here, the hiking buddies that we go every Sunday so we can complain about the world, get it out on Sunday, and then the rest of the week we're serene. That I found that whatever I thought was the right thing to do, I needed to check that with somebody. Because I was still full of stinking thinking. And my sponsor over there told me, I don't think you should date that woman. I don't know if he remembers this. And I did. I shouldn't have dated that woman. The relationship went so well that she moved to Pittsburgh. That was sort of the last time that I made a decision on my own about that. But people that have suffered like me know what it's like, right? They've been to hell. And they made stupid decisions too. And if they're standing over here away from you, they empathize enough and understand what's going on with you, but they can give you a more objective opinion about that next thing you're going to do. So sponsorship and the community, really, really important. Of course, going to meetings, reading the big book, you know, also very important. For me, and this is for me, so it's the community of AA, and actually I even go hiking with people on the psych side. Kind of spooky, isn't it? Just looking at some of my hiking buds on the yellow folder holders. Yeah. That's kept me sane. I am an introvert and a loner. They force me out of my house to do stuff. Sometimes they say, you want to go out for dinner after we do our hike? And I'll say, no, I think I need to go home and be alone. And they're okay with that, right? Because they sort of know who I am. For me, I'm going to say the most important aspect of my recovery has been having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I gave up on religion at the same time I thought spirituality didn't really exist, it was just religion. And I started to explore my version of spirituality. It's not Christianity, although I read a lot of Christian thought. I started practicing Tibetan Buddhism when I was drinking, which they don't mix either. But the thing that program taught me, right? Every morning you've got to have a morning meditation. That meditation saved my butt. Because the way I got rid of the panic attacks was to say, this isn't going to kill me, it's not going to last forever, and if I meditate, it won't be so bad. So when I first started doing this, the practice, sometimes the panic attack would go on for 4 or 5 hours, which wasn't that much fun, but I was working on meditation. So if you've ever had a panic attack, imagine attempting to count to 21 without making a mistake. I would get like to 3 or 4 and go, where was I? And go back and start and go, right? But that mindfulness meditation, learning to live in the moment, learning to live life on life's terms, has kept me going. I practice my spirituality. I meditate every day. I read about my spirituality every day. I think about it every day. It is part of my life. My students probably think I'm a bit odd because I'm teaching an ecology course and I started out with a quote from the Buddha. And I should repeat that quote to you. When he first obtained enlightenment, he went to do his first teaching, and what he said to the people he talked to was, listen to what I say, evaluate it in the context of your understanding, and if any of it makes sense, it's yours. And that's really important to me. That I know a lot of people that disagree with me and that I disagree with them. I try not to have arguments anymore. Sometimes I just have to walk away. Sometimes I got all these holes in my tongue. That's not from the piercings, that's from my canine teeth. You know, biting on the tongue. But my anger used to just come like that. And when it comes like that and you don't have any time to take a breath, you're yelling at somebody. I have yelled at university presidents, the CFO of the university, bunches of high-level administrators. I don't know how I kept my job. And I haven't cursed at an administrator in, guess what, 10 years, almost 10 years. So that spiritual practice, that working a program, allows me the honor to stand up here and talk to you tonight. I don't know if I've said anything of value to you, but it works if you work it. It is not easy. It's hard, but it's worth the effort. So, in fact, I think in the fall of 2011, I was reincarnated as a different human being. If you'd known me 11 years ago, you wouldn't, well, except for the long hair, you wouldn't have known it was the same person. And I must be just about done, yeah? Is that about it? Yeah. So one last story. So I try and live in the moment. So I'm getting ready to leave the office this afternoon, and I get this message on Facebook from a friend who has moved to New Zealand, partly related to COVID. And the message was, "Do you have time to talk to me this afternoon, or can I talk to you tonight?" And I started to write the message that was, "I've got to go home now, and I got to go out tonight." And I said, "What the am I doing? Somebody's asking for my help." So I phoned her, and she answered the phone, and she was crying, and she just needed to talk to somebody. Her life had become unmanageable, right? She's moved to a new country, although she's a citizen, but she never really lived there. She's moved to a new country. She thought after 5 months she would have a job. She does not. She thought her husband would have a job. He does not. Their son has started university, and it's just too much for her. So I spent an extra 45 minutes on the phone trying to work her through the problem that she was faced. And that made me think, and right, I wasn't supposed to tell you folks that, but it's part of my story, so just as soon as you leave the room, forget I said I did that. But that's what service work is all about. When somebody reaches out to you, you put out a hand. Because people put their hands out to me, and it's my time to give back to the recovery community. And guess what? Those earth people that we think are so different from us, not so much. They have the same problems. Maybe they didn't use the solution that I did, but they still need to talk to somebody to figure out, how do I make this decision? What do I do? This is what my son says I should do. This is, you know, and right? And when I talk to her, it's listen to what I say, evaluate it, and if any of it makes sense, it's yours. Because I don't really know what, I mean, she's on the other side of the world. I don't really know what she should do, but I gave her the advice that I thought would help her. And that service work, particularly when I first became a sponsor, I would have, you know, relationship problems or something would be going terrible in my life, and a sponsee would phone, and all of a sudden I didn't have any problems. I've had wives of sponsees call me and say, "He's trying to break into the apartment now, what do I do?" That takes your mind off your problems. And so that service work, first of all, hopefully you're doing good for others, but it actually serves me very well too. It's my honor to do it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I never would have been able to do those things with other human beings unless I had gone through Ridgeview. I will finish with, I came into Ridgeview and I only had to do two things: stop the drugs and alcohol and change everything else about my life. If I can do it, you can do it. Thank you very much for listening.
Pam, come here. You're giving out chips.
All right. Thank you, John, for telling your story. By the way, everyone's coming to John's house later for a party. All right.